Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, here with some shining stars and black holes of a week in culture. And this week, we celebrate the start of the summer of Lavbourne as the Hunt Museum opens a new exhibition from the Don't Call Them Impressionist Irish painters John Lavery and Walter Osborne. We join the Experimentals on Sherkin for a festival of Out There on an Island sounds. And to get things started, we capture the rebel cry of guitarist John Williams, a man now more easily and perhaps less fairly associated with the easiest of easy listening. Guitarist Michael O'Toole has moved his fingers from the fretboard to the keyboard for a book that attempts to think again about John Williams and his instrument. On the way, John Williams, changing the culture of classical guitar, tells of the relationship of two colossal guitar heroes, Williams and Andreas Segovia, each of whom in their own way helped create the guitar as the instrument we know today, which is where our conversation with Michael O'Toole begins.
The guitar was a popular instrument, and the story, as it's told, a lot of history books have been written since Segovia became so famous, and a lot of them tell a story of an instrument which was neglected and often derided up until that point, up until Segovia gave the guitar its respect. Although, having done that, he established a very elitist kind of aesthetic around the classical guitar, trying to kind of separate it from other styles of guitar because he felt that it needed to be differentiated and people needed to know that the classical guitar was somehow better than other styles. When Williams came along as Segovia's student, he was more open to other influences, and he really felt a guitar is a guitar is a guitar. He felt he wanted to, if he was a great classical guitarist, he wanted to play with great jazz guitarists, he wanted to play with different musicians. This was before Yo-Yo Ma was doing this, it was before a lot of the even John McLaughlin and people like that were crossing over.
It's important that Segovia was Spanish because there was a particular culture around the guitar that obviously predated the kind of entry into the concert hall of the guitar.
Guitar is constantly associated with Spain, probably in the way that the Irish harp is associated with us. But it's really, really part of the psyche in Spain. And that became to be a very, very important aspect of the guitar's evolution because during the years of conquest and exploration from the 1500s on, the Spanish, of course, took the guitar. They went to South America and they conquered all these different lands and they always brought guitars with them everywhere they went. So the guitar has kind of seeped into all these different cultures. To an extent, Segovia's repertoire and what he focused on when he concertized was very, very European. He was very Eurocentric and he had a slight colonial feel about how he viewed South American music and anything remotely folk-like. And that was where I think things had to change. Williams' father was an extremely talented musician himself, Len Williams, and Len decided when he saw how good John was about 11 at the time, he decided to go back to Europe again, back to London. He decided that was the place to be for John. Williams, in many ways, is one of the first prodigies on the guitar. He was so good at the age of 12. When Segovia was on tour in London, John played for him and Segovia was very impressed and arranged for Williams to study with him in a summer school in Siena. Very, very famous summer school with all kinds of different guitarists there that he met. Also Daniel Barenboim was there. He became a lifelong friend and various other people. You know, a lot of those people that you associate with that London scene in the 50s and 60s then. So they had a teacher and pupil relationship. Segovia was extremely conservative about the way music should be played, and the type of music that Williams played was just really the antithesis of what he had sought to achieve.
He was also very pro-Franco.
Oh, he was. Segovia was extremely pro-Franco. Actually, some letters emerged since Segovia's death, some letters that he had written to a composer, Manuel Maria Ponte. He's quite anti-Semitic in them as well, and he doesn't seem to understand the plight of the Jewish people in during that time. He mentions that Jewish impresarios seem to be against him in America, seemed to be plotting against him. And he also he mentions not wanting to upset things by letting his political convictions be fully known. But he mentions in those letters that he's contributing to Franco financially as well. And I suppose in contrast, that Williams was from a totally different middle class, very, very left wing family, very politically active. His parents were really, really active. And Williams himself, from even his teen years, was organising concerts for CND, as it was at the time. And he's always been very much to the forefront. Some of the great music that Williams has made has actually been for political ends. He played the music of Mikis Theodorakis, the Greek exiled composer, when there was a military regime in place there. He played with Inti Illimani, who are the great Chilean group, again, when Pinochet was in power there. And he's always kind of gone and really worn his heart in his sleeve with regard to that, you know. And I suppose Williams' sentiments within the artistic community, Williams' sentiments, I suppose, rest easier with us. So I guess Segovia's
a fascist.
He's a fascist.
Let's not beat about the bush.
Yeah. And it just sort of, it doesn't go down as well. In fact, in America in the 30s, Segovia's career was almost ruined because there was a boycott on his concerts, and he spent a long time in South America. But his career managed to recover as sort of, I suppose, memories dimmed and people just moved on.
Williams is kind of associated with the modernizing of the concert hall in general. I mean, it wasn't just what happened to the guitar that he sort of had influence on.
Absolutely, yeah. Williams was part of a group, Jacqueline Dupré, Daniel Barenboim, Ashkenazi. They were all friends in London, and they were all changing things, I think. They were becoming almost more like pop stars in a way. People were allowed to get to know them and see them behind backstage and see them in sort of, you know, not just walking out and being great on stage. And Williams was the one who decided he just didn't feel comfortable playing in the tie and tails and everything like that. And he decided he would just walk out in casual dress. A number followed him. Ashkenazi followed him straight away. Ashkenazi actually was quoted as saying it was easier for John to get away with it because he was a guitarist. So I suppose that does show you where the guitar was viewed sometimes. But at the same time, I think he was probably right because of the crossover nature of the guitar. I think Williams probably could get away with that. It seems crazy to say it even now, but it was a thing, you know, in the 60s.
Well, you point out that people were writing to Ashkenazi's agent to protest his unprofessionalism. And that's to do with what he was wearing.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And I think Williams was, one reviewer mentioned that he was like a cross between the Don Cossack Chorus and Dr. Kildare. You know, a reviewer just mentioned that as a sort of a slight on him. Williams was very influential in terms of, as time moved on, in terms of amplification, the idea that guitarists would amplify in order to play in bigger concert halls. Segovia was really against this. And many other guitarists, Julian Bream wasn't majorly in favour of this. Again, that comes back to the reach that Williams had, because Williams was willing to amplify and get that done properly and make a good compromise on that issue. He was able to play to 3,000 people at a time in concert halls, you know, to play the really huge venues.
And of course, all the other activities that Williams was involved in helped him fill the big concert halls, because he was on, you know, the Morecambe and Wise show, or he was constantly on comedy shows, variety shows on the television at the time.
Yeah, he did a huge number of stuff, of things like that. And he always says, when it's put to him, he's very he downplays a lot of that, because he never feels he made some big decision to do that. He says, it was offered to me, and I would have been a fool not to, you know, not to play in front of 24 million people on the Les Dawson show or the Val Dunican show and get the guitar across the people. And certainly when I was growing up myself, Williams was the first guitarist I heard, and it was on shows like that that I heard him. I think it really did have a big reach. I think the accusation at the time was that maybe he was a little bit too accessible and he was making the guitar too easy for people. But I think that really doesn't hold. That sounds very outdated when you even say it now. You don't even really have to argue the point, I think, at this stage.
At the end of Segovia's life, what was their relationship?
It was okay. Anytime Segovia was in town in London, Williams would meet him and he would often play for him, but there was a frostiness between them. In a funny way, as Segovia said himself, that Williams in a way went in a different direction to Segovia, but in another way, as a person who'd been anointed as his own successor, Williams did fulfil that role. He just did it in his own way, I think. I think to do exactly what Segovia had done previously would have, in the era Williams grew up on, wouldn't have worked as well either. So I think from that point of view, I don't think Segovia could see it that way. It just wasn't possible for him to see it that way.
I was looking at the cover of The Art of the Guitar, where you have the two of them, and I think when you look at those photographs, you can see the difference in how they play, because Segovia is very upright and he's almost leaning backwards, and John Williams has his chin is practically on the strings, yeah, as he's kind of cuddling it up to him.
Yeah.
Is that just the moment they were playing, or does that say something about the way they played?
I think there's an interesting parallel with Julian Bream even here as well. In the things people say about the instrument, it's very interesting. Segovia, most of his pronouncements about the guitar were to do with he would say the guitar was at a very bad way when I found it. When I found the guitar, he often made these speeches where he said, when I found the guitar, it was in such a disarray and it was plagued by folk music, and I had to do this, that, and the other to fix it. And Bream sometimes has sort of regarded himself as a sort of a pioneer and someone who tried to get respect for the guitar. Bream did it in a different way to Segovia. He wanted to get top rank composers like Benjamin Britten, William Walton to write for guitar, and he succeeded.
Segovia actually kind of hated contemporary composition.
Hated contemporary composition. Yeah, absolutely. He wouldn't, and that's why he. I suppose people felt that Segovia missed a trick with that, because at a time even Stravinsky was willing to write for the guitar and Segovia refused. So Bream filled that gap really and did it really well and was super. But in a sense, they both felt that they were taking the guitar and trying to fix it, trying to get it so that classical musicians would admire it again, or ever. Maybe they were feeling they never admired it. Whereas I think Williams is one of the few, he's the one that stands out as the guy that really loved the guitar. He found the guitar, saw the music that had been played on it for hundreds of years, and liked all of it, and wanted to play all of it. One of Williams' best albums is El Diablo Suelto, a beautiful Venezuelan album where he plays arrangements of 20, 22 or 23 beautiful Venezuelan songs, and they're just gorgeous. I think that's Williams finding music in a country, but not necessarily looking for a great work that's going to save the guitar, just really saying, this is what the guitar does in Venezuela, and isn't it great? And I love that about him. But I also do love what Bream did. I'm not saying it was a bad thing. I think it was very necessary for the two of them to come along when they did, you know. And Bream almost to be the serious big brother, you know, where Williams is going off on these crazy popular journeys.
Michael O'Toole there, and his book, John Williams, Changing the Culture of the Classical Guitar, is out now from Routledge. Next, everything you've ever wanted to know about Walter Osborne and John Lavery, but were sure somebody would mention if you just stayed quiet long enough. At Limerick's Hunt Museum, those early modernist Irish, all those adjectives are fairly contested, artists, nouns are easier, are coming together for Lavery and Osborne Observing Life, featuring 62 paintings by the pair. Art historian Catherine Milligan is one of those taking part in this week's symposium at the Hunt on the life and works of Lavborne. No way that'll catch on. Before that, Catherine Milligan came to Culturefile Towers to untangle the threaded lives of two Irish painters who never actually met.
This exhibition is actually one of the first times they are really being talked about together. And I think it's an interesting project to bring them together. We don't think they met each other, really, I think what's interesting in looking at them together is these kind of outward connections. You know, they're both Irish artists, both in their time have been considered British artists, but yet they, you know, they always kind of come back. They're these late 19th into the 20th century Irish artists that bring us into Europe. What these two artists give us, Osborne and Lavery, is an international Irish artist, rather than we might look at, say, with the kind of artists involved with the Celtic Revival. They're not politically active in a sense. They are not involved with nationalist politics. Lavery is born in kind of a working class Catholic family in Belfast, but then is mainly brought up in Scotland after his parents both die quite tragically, and Osborne grows up in kind of unionist Rathmines, middle class unionist Rathmines. So they have these quite contrasting backgrounds, but it's really when they go away from Ireland that they kind of blossom, I suppose, as artists. They both have very strong connections to Britain, Lavery particularly to Glasgow and then to London. Osborne certainly exhibits in London, in Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, kind of the regional British cities as well as London. He travels extensively in the south of England. So they have these lives that travel between Ireland, Britain, France and Belgium. So they're moving around. Lavery goes to Tangier in Morocco. So he kind of is interested, I suppose, a little bit in Orientalism and how that intersects with kind of Impressionism and modern painting. So constantly moving, bringing, I suppose, these Irish roots out into the world and then through exhibition back to Ireland as well. If you want to be extremely pedantic about it, you could say, of course, they're both British because they're born before Irish independence. Osborne, after his death, was frequently described as a British painter. After he died, the Magazine of Art described him as a British painter. And his brother, Charles Osborne, took great offence to this and wrote to them and said, my family have been Irish for many generations. We're descended from Cromwellian settlers, which many people would maybe take a point with. But he certainly felt that his brother should be regarded as an Irish artist. He himself was very committed to the promoting Irish art, to establishing Irish art, though not in that overtly nationalist way. Lavery is slightly more complex in that he does really make his career in Britain. He accepts a knighthood. He's very involved in the First World War as a painter of the home front. And so he has, I suppose, kind of more of this kind of dual identity, this hybrid identity. I suppose stylistically, there are similarities, particularly through the 1880s and into the 1890s in their work. Osborne went from Dublin, from the Royal Hibernian Academy schools, to the Académie des Beaux-Arts in Antwerp, where he would have been working in kind of these styles of naturalism, realism, and very much influenced by Bastien Lepage. He's a French artist, as I say, working around the same time. He comes from rural France. And really what he does is move art away from the kind of classical and mythological, the kind of high tradition in France, the salon paintings, very smooth, glossy paintings. Whereas Bastien Lepage moves us into something more earthy, rural, but that is different from Impressionism. So he's not aligned, say, with Monet and those artists who are working together. When we think of kind of Impressionism with a kind of capital I, that is Monet and his contemporaries, we think of a very fragmented picture plane. Whereas with Lepage, he's very much using something called the square brush technique, which is much blockier. The paint isn't fragmented and separated as it will be in the work of Monet. It's still smooth, but as I say, the colours are kind of greys, browns, very earthy greens, and with a real emphasis on rural life, farming life.
Will this exhibition change outside Ireland how people see these two artists?
I would hope it would. It really is an opportunity for people to re-engage with what they think 19th century Irish art is. I think still we tend to think of Irish art as being maybe a little bit insular, as being completely focused on the rural kind of west of Ireland kind of seaboard and the West of Ireland paintings. But really what we have in these two artists are examples of how artists from Ireland were participating in a wider European art history, in an artistic culture of their day.
In a way that shouldn't be surprising when you look at the literature of the period.
Absolutely not. I think there is a tendency for people to engage more with literature than with art. I'm not sure why, but certainly we have as active a group of artists as we do writers. It's something I've noticed with looking at Dublin paintings. I mean, if you say to people, you know, how do you view Dublin and culture, you'll always have, you know, Ulysses, Dubliners, Portrait of the Artist, Patrick Kavanagh, but actually there is as a vibrant a group of artists painting the city, and that tends to be a little bit more overlooked.
Dr. Catherine Milligan there, postdoctoral fellow at the UCD School of Art History and Cultural Policy, and she'll be among those speaking at the Lavery Osborne Symposium at the Hunt Museum tomorrow, Saturday, June 8th. The exhibition Lavery and Osborne Observing Life runs at the museum all summer long. And finally on this week's Weekly, closely miked blades of grass, YouTube videos of British soldiers in Iraq, a cat purring. These are among the raw materials for artists operating in Ireland's sometimes overlooked experimental music scene, many of whom gathered over the weekend at Open Ear Festival on Sherkin Island. Now in its fourth year, and with the addition of sound artist Vicky Langan as a programmer, the festival showcased its biggest lineup to date, including site-specific work from Áine O'Dwyer, a live performance from sound ecologist Michael Prime, and the launch of All the Many Peoples, a new album from perhaps Ireland's leading composer, Jennifer Walsh. Culture Files' Rachel Andrews took ship to Sherkin in search of an adventure in sound.
My name is Vicky Langan. I'm one of the three programmers for Open Ear. My background is in, I suppose, experimental music, noise music, weirdo music. Open Ear's invitation to bring me on board as a programmer, I guess, was based on my history as an experimental music maker or sound artist myself. And, you know, I used to program an awful lot of experimental concerts in Cork. But then a lot of the work on, you know, across this whole bill, everybody, whether they're producers or folk singers or, you know, all the other types of players who are on this island this weekend, essentially everybody here is doing something experimental.
My name's Jennifer Walsh.
What more wonderful a place than Sherkin Island to do something like this?
Yeah, it's a nice place to launch.
The album has its roots back in sort of the early years of this decade, sort of watching the internet crack open, and as sort of Web 2.0 and social media began to have more and more of a presence, and sort of seeing two things. One, this huge new deluge of language, having access to all this, seeing people make jokes in new ways, people misspell things, people ask Google very bizarre questions that Google autocomplete then tells you about.
Not at all weird on the Sunday. The robot on its feet by the tampons, and the rainbow on its head by the Xbox, and the celebrity dog.
I found, you know, text on the internet where people were saying, you know, Google queries about spells to make you a mermaid, spells to make you a mermaid which actually work, you know. And you think that's just amazing, in that I'm not just finding text, I'm finding this intimate relationship that people have had with Google, enough that enough people have typed they really need a spell to make them a mermaid, you know, that it's remembering that. So I think that's what's very interesting about the web, is that it's showing us found text that's not just a diary entry, but that's really at times some of our most private, you know, queries about our lives. A lot of people, if they're worried about their health, the first place they're going to go is Dr. Google, you know, and say, you know, does the scratch on my hand mean I'll die? That's what I think is fascinating about the web. It's for good or for bad, you know, we're seeing these details of human behavior in a way we haven't seen them before.
And on the Sunday week, the robot on its face by the unicorn, and the rainbow on its side by the tampons, and the celebrity dog on its feet by the Xbox, and the AK-47 on its head by the massage table.
This is Natalia Bayliss.
You are playing here at the Open Air Festival with Woven Skull.
Yeah, this is our first time down here. First time down here for any of us. It's lovely, first time in Shirkin, so beautiful. There's three of us that are the core of the band, and we've played with a lot of different people over the years, so we always have different musicians coming in with us, but it's always the three of us. Myself and the drummer live in the countryside, so we're quite inspired by the sounds of... We live in Leitrim, so we're quite inspired by the sounds of Leitrim. And then Angus lives in Dublin, guitar player, so he's quite immersed in city sounds. So I think that's nice. It kind of brings a good dynamic where you're kind of getting those nice country sounds and that real gentleness mixed with like that harsh kind of gritty city sound. But we're all very open to experimenting with throwing everything in and just kind of pick up whatever's around or record whatever's going on. And the Cappers, that's Chairman Meow, our cat. So that's our recording I have of him purring, yeah.
That's a 1 hour recording.
The poor thing. I feel like I exploit the animals. I'm always like, purr for me.
A festival like this, being on an island, so small and with such generous residents who are so supportive of the festival and really like work with us throughout the year to make sure that it can continue to happen. It would be crazy to try to grow it, you know, any more. That it's the right size. You know, it's enough just to have one nice big tent that everybody can have this experience together in. It's pretty perfect.
Vicky Langan there on Shirkin Island talking to Culturefile's Rachel Andrews at last weekend's Open Ear Festival, bringing to a close this edition of the Culturefile Weekly. We'll be back with more Sonic Sailing next Friday at 7 p.m. Until then, bye now.